clearly is the front runner. There was no reasonable alternative that was identified.
Good news for Fairbanks businesses and Eielson. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the federal government wants $12 million back from the Mat-Su Borough.
We have been working diligently the last 2.5 years to resolve this issue. We have not been successful yet.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. We encourage you to enroll for VA health care benefits. Go to 1010ez.med.va.gov to apply online in less than 5 minutes, or print, fax, or mail the 2-page form to the VA. You do not need your DD-214 to apply. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message is sponsored by the VA.
There's good news for the Fairbanks business community today. The Secretary of the Air Force called Alaska's congressional delegation this morning to announce that Eielson Air Force Base is the only candidate selected to house two squadrons of F-35 fighter planes. The final decision won't come until the fall of 2015 after a study of the environmental impact, but Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's confident.
Eielson clearly is the front runner. There was no reasonable alternative that was identified. They moved straight to the preferred alternative, which I think is really quite compelling for Eielson.
The Air Force cited Eielson's strategic position on the globe, the wide open airspace and training range, and the support of the local community. Senator Mark Begich says he expects the 48 planes will bring several hundred jobs, and all told, some 2,000 people, including family members. Begich gave credit to the Tiger Team, the Fairbanks and Interior leaders who promote Eielson.
They came out in droves. They had information. They had data. They went to every public hearing. They made sure that the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, heard from Alaskans firsthand why this base location in Alaska was the right decision, especially at Eielson.
The F-35A is a single-seat, single-engine fighter with stealth technology that can also carry heavy bombs. The federal government wants the Matanuska Susitna Borough to pay back $12.3 million in grants related to the ferry MV Susitna. Mat-Su Borough Manager John Moosey made the announcement today at a press conference in Palmer.
We have been working diligently the last 2.5 years to resolve this issue. We have not been successful yet.
Moosey said borough assembly members will meet in a special meeting next week to decide what to do. He said it is not clear what will happen if the borough fails to pay.
We hope not to find out, but we, at this point in time, are looking for an alternative solution other than paying $12.3 million back.
The Federal Transit Authority letter received this week indicates there is a 30-day deadline on the payment. Moosey said that a delegation from the borough visited Washington, D.C. last December to speak with the secretary of the FTA to present everything the borough has done to resolve the issue of the ferry, but unsuccessfully.
So at that time, we talked about many options that we could do and really threw out some discussion items. So essentially, this action, this letter, really allows us now to sit down and talk turkey and work out how this is going to be resolved.
Moosey said the borough will respond to the FTA within the 30-day time frame. He says the amount of money is not in dispute. The borough has been trying to sell the ferry for years for about $6 million, with no success to try to recover costs of its upkeep. The Susitna is berthed in Ketchikan, which initially cost the borough $30,000 per month, although in recent months that cost has been reduced.
And that has been part of our challenge, is we have the boat, which we have in Ketchikan, that we have monthly costs on. At the same time, we have this grant from the FTA that needs to be resolved. So we're getting pinched both ways on this issue.
MATSU Port Director Mark von Dongen says about $4 million of the $12.3 million paid for the Port McKenzie Terminal building, among other things. The ferry was paid for by the U.S. Navy, but was given to the borough with certain provisions tied to the millions of dollars in grants that went with it. Moosey said the borough's plan is to use the ferry between the borough's plan to use the ferry between Port McKenzie and Anchorage fell apart when the borough failed to get a second influx of money to build ferry landings on both sides of Kinnick Arm. The two leading Republican U.S. Senate candidates are increasingly turning on each other. Last week, Dan Sullivan sent 50,000 mailers to Alaska voters alleging Mead Treadwell benefited financially from the Obama stimulus package, a bill he denounces on the campaign trail. This week, Treadwell is fighting back, and he's taking aim at the Ohio paint conglomerate Sullivan's family runs. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Sullivan, in his mailer, says Treadwell was on the board of a Maryland dredge building company that took $6 million from the Obama stimulus bill. Disclosure documents show Treadwell sold shares of Ellicott Dredges for $1.1 million in 2009. As the mailer puts it, Treadwell used Obama's stimulus to line his own bank account, and Alaskans are footing the bill. Treadwell says Sullivan is overstating his connection to the dredge company. He wants Alaskans to take a hard look at RPM International, the paint company Sullivan's grandfather founded and Sullivan's brother runs. According to a government database of stimulus spending, RPM International got contracts worth more than $15 million from the stimulus bill, mostly through its roofing division called Tremco. Treadwell points out that Dan Sullivan owns shares of RPM worth up to $1 million.
So I'd say, examine thyself, Mr. Sullivan.
This is a case of parallel accusations. Both Sullivan and Treadwell decry the Obama administration's spending. Each candidate is linked to a different Lower 48 company that does a lot of business with the government, a bit of it funded with Obama's stimulus money. Each says he has no sway over the company's decision to take that money, but says the other guy's ties to the company are significant and relevant to the campaign. Sullivan holds no position at RPM and has no legal say in the business, which includes brands like Rust-Oleum and DAP, and has 10,000 employees around the world. Treadwell says Alaskans should still care about how RPM makes its money because executives of the company have contributed heavily to Sullivan's campaign.
But, you know, I don't have the money to do a mailer to 50,000 people to, you know, do that.
Campaign finance reports show RPM employees and their spouses have given $130,000 to Sullivan's campaign, helping make Ohio Sullivan's number one state for contributions. Also, Sullivan's brother Frank, the CEO of RPM, their father, and an ex-RPM board member contributed a combined $125,000 to a super PAC running ads to support Sullivan and tarnish rivals. Aside from the stimulus money, Treadwell points out RPM was sued in 2010 over its business practices.
I just would say take a look at where his money's coming from, both his personal wealth, his ability to take a year off from any employment to run for office, his ability to come in with so much money to begin with, and most of it goes right back to a company called RPM, which settled last August for $60-plus million for overcharging the U.S. government.
In that case, Tremco, RPM's roofing division, was accused under the False Claims Act of price gouging and selling the government defective products. The claims involved roofs on 150 public buildings, including schools, post offices, and more than a dozen veterans hospitals.
An Ohio roofing company is accused of ripping off state governments across the country.
The Northeast Ohio company agrees to pay back millions of dollars of your tax money.
In August, Tremco reached a settlement with the Department of Justice for $61 million.
In a press release about the settlement a year ago, RPM CEO Frank Sullivan said the company sometimes charged the government the wrong price. The Sullivan campaign wouldn't speak on tape for this story, but issued a statement saying Sullivan had nothing to do with the activity in question and that he's proud of the company his brother and grandfather built. Treadwell says the Sullivan mailer against him is wrong. He sold most of the stock in Ellicott and resigned from the board before the company won its largest chunk of stimulus money, $4 million for a dredge it sold the government. He was on the board when the company applied for a $1.75 million grant to upgrade machinery, but says that wasn't a board decision. Sullivan campaign spokesman Mike Anderson said last week the mailer was accurate because Treadwell didn't sever his ties to Ellicott. According to his financial disclosure form, Treadwell still owns a six-figure stake in the company and receives board compensation. Treadwell says he's paid $1,000 to attend board meetings as a non-voting advisor. While the front-running Republican candidates go after each other, Democratic operatives working to re-elect Senator Mark Begich are enjoying the fireworks and taking notes. In Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A lawyer hired by Senator Lisa Murkowski's re-election campaign today sent a cease and desist letter to the campaign of Senator Mark Begich. She is demanding that he quit using her name and image in his political ads. Begich is currently running a TV spot called Great Team that says they vote alike 80% of the time, a statistic that holds true for 2014 so far. The Murkowski letter says Begich is using her image to suggest her support, even though she has said she wants a Republican to win. The letter also accuses the Begich campaign of misusing Senate resources because the ad features a photo of the two senators in Murkowski's Senate office. A spokesman for the Begich camp says the 2008 photo was taken by the Associated Press and purchased by the campaign. Senator Begich said today the ad is accurate and he will continue to air accurate ads. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, trouble for a vessel captain under the influence.
He did not pass the field sobriety test, and at that point, the Coast Guard terminated the vessel's voyage.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
The 17-year-old who hit and killed Anchorage bicyclist Jeffrey Dusenberry in July is being charged with manslaughter, a Class A felony. Alexandra Ann Ellis is being tried as an adult. She's also charged with driving under the influence and leaving the scene without rendering assistance. She will be arraigned tomorrow. Dusenberry was biking on July 19th when he was struck by Ellis as she was backing up her pickup. He died shortly after. Neighbors witnessed the event. Last election cycle, state legislator Mia Costello's opponents falsely alleged that she didn't actually live in the Sand Lake neighborhood of Anchorage that she represents. Now, similar charges are being leveled in the same district, but against a new candidate. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
There's a pretty lengthy paper trail suggesting that Republican candidate Sherry Jackson does not live in District 22. The Casper Courthouse she owns is on the wrong side of Jewel Lake Road, putting it in a neighboring district. The senior housing facility where Jackson works is listed as her place of residence. Her 2013 fishing license uses Casper Court as her residence, and so does the absentee ballot she cast in November 2012. Jackson's opponent in the Republican primary, Liz Vasquez, is so convinced that Jackson can't run in the district that she's hired a lawyer to pursue the claim. Attorney Scott Kendall thinks the residency question is an open-shut case.
The thought that she somehow lives at her employer's house, which is a half mile from her actual residence that she's owned for 15 years, is farcical, to say the least.
The Vasquez campaign alleges that Jackson changed her voter registration to her employer's address after redistricting maps were finalized last July, and her Casper Court home was sliced out of that area. Vasquez complained to the Division of Elections in June, but missed the deadline to challenge Jackson's candidacy at that point. Elections Director Gail Fanoumiai dismissed the complaint, and Vasquez chose not to appeal the decision in court because of the cost. But had Vasquez submitted the complaint in time, Fanoumiai would have initiated an investigation and judged Jackson's residency by this metric.
When we ask somebody who, say, is, like, I'm going to use it like a homeless person example, we say, where do you sleep at night? Where is it? Where do you sleep? And they tell us where they sleep, and that's where we consider the where their residence is for voter registration.
So I went to find out where Sherry Jackson sleeps. Jewel Lake Plaza is right at the edge of District 22. It's got more than a dozen apartments for low-income seniors with Section 8 vouchers. To enter, you have to be buzzed in, and Mark and Sherry Jackson's names are at the top of the directory.
Hi, is this Mark Jackson?
Yeah.
Hi, my name's Alexander Gutierrez, and I'm am looking for Sherry.
Well, she's working tonight.
Even though his wife is out, Mark Jackson invites me in for a look. The place is furnished, the refrigerators are covered in magnets and photos, and there are Sherry Jackson for State House signs in the windows.
I don't know how it, you know, you would assume that we don't live here from, you know, having a stack full of books, plants, and everything else that goes in the house. So this is where we live. But I do own a house over on Casper, but my children live there.
Mark explains that Sherry is the on-site representative at Jewel Lake Plaza, and that they moved there 2 years ago as part of the job. Their kids are in their 20s, so they let them occupy the Casper Court home. As I'm about to leave, Sherry arrives. She says she's aware of the residency complaint, but doesn't put stock into it.
I'm not going to put myself or my family in a situation that is going to be under such scrutiny that you make a fool out of yourself. It's not worth it.
She shows me a letter from September 2012 documenting their move, and we talk to a Jewel Lake Plaza resident who vouches for the Jacksons as neighbors. Jackson admits that her paperwork could raise some eyebrows, though. She says that because the Casper Court property is still in her name, she would sometimes use it instead of her post office box. She adds that she used the Casper Court address on the 2012 absentee ballot because she had just moved, and she and her husband were traveling for a family illness.
I guess that could look bad in a way, but that's the reality of my situation. You know, a lot of times people don't put addresses in until after they settle down. We didn't even have a chance to move our stuff in, and we took a plane out of here.
Jackson does not plan to withdraw from the Republican primary. While state statute does not allow people to claim temporary work sites for their residency, Jackson thinks her situation qualifies as permanent. Her opponent, Liz Vasquez, referred questions to her lawyer. Scott Kendall still believes that Jackson should not be eligible to run.
I guess I'm far from convinced based on the fact that she was simply there and had stuff there. Certainly, since filing in May of this year, she's had plenty of time to occupy a unit there. Again, she's not entitled to live there but for working there, so it is her work site.
This isn't the first controversy over election rules in District 22 this campaign cycle. The Republican primary was initially supposed to be a three-way race, but David Neese's candidacy was rejected because of paperwork problems. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Local Alaskan organizations are trying to promote entrepreneurship to diversify the economy. Last week, the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation hosted the second annual Pitch on a Train competition. KSKA's Ann Hillman joined them for the journey.
Traveling down the railroad tracks towards Whittier, five teams prepare to sell their ideas. They're pitching business plans that could work in Alaska in a setting that doesn't let them forget the uniqueness of where they live. Without PowerPoints and graphics, they have to both maintain their balance on a moving train and distract the panel of nine judges from the rugged scenery of Turnagain Arm. All but one of the judges is from the state. Among the competitors is Dwayne Halverson. He's pitching a product he developed for his hunting camp called Roving Blue. It's a portable water purification system that uses ozone to kill pathogens. Ozonated water can be used as a disinfectant, too. He says the unit runs on batteries or solar power and can clean enough water for about 250 people.
So you can see the applications worldwide are enormous. FEMA, hurricane, tornado disaster, anywhere where your water supply is interrupted. Galena, for example. There you go. So it's something that can really contribute greatly to mankind.
But is it marketable? A good investment? Judge Terry Jones, who founded Travelocity, says these are the questions the judges are asking.
Well, a good pitch and a good idea are different because the pitch is more than the idea. The pitch is about putting it to work. Remember, creativity is about thinking up new things. Innovation is about doing them.
That was what the Anchorage Startup Weekend winners wanted to do, to turn the hard-to-grasp idea of bitcoins into something people see as functional. Bitcoins are money that's mined on the internet using mathematical algorithms. At the moment, one Bitcoin is worth about $580. But Travis Krause says they aren't so easy to spend.
Right now, it takes over 3 days to take Bitcoin and turn it into U.S. dollars so you can go buy a taco. We take that three-day process and we turn it into a three-second card swipe.
How?
Magic.
In the 5 days since the team formed, they created a credit card called Swipe API that can be used anywhere in the world to buy things with any type of cybercurrency. And it already works.
Well, I bought coffee with it this morning. And then I bought espresso with it later on this morning again.
Krause's team says that if Bitcoin was easy to use, then maybe the 99% of the population that doesn't really understand it might start. So did the judges think they had a great pitch? The best of the five? They announced the winners during lunch.
Fifth place is Swipe API.
The team says they didn't expect to win, but they didn't expect to be last either. Team member Lance Ahern says it was still a positive experience.
That experience of going through, of putting our information together, getting out in front of the judges, presenting the idea, I think it's good. We need to go through that.
Ahern says Anchorage Bitcoin users are already paying to be part of the trial. As for the water treatment idea, it fared a bit better. They came in second. Judge Jones says their product could go somewhere with some work.
I think the water cleaning system is awesome. I think they need marketing help to understand how to price it and where to go with it.
Other pitches included a timeshare luxury jet and software to control drones for everything from fighting fires to cleaning gutters. But the ultimate winner? A tried and true idea, expanding a Juneau homemade ice cream business that features rhubarb sherbet to include an ice cream truck down by the cruise ship docks. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A whale-watching captain arrested yesterday in Juneau had a blood alcohol level almost three times the federal legal limit. 67-year-old Lawrence Dupler was arrested for driving a 52-foot tour boat while intoxicated. Known as Captain Larry, Dupler works for Juneau tour company Orca Enterprises. He's been a whale-watching captain since 1994 and started working for Orca in 1997. He was operating the vessel Orca Odyssey Wednesday morning, which had 13 passengers on board. Juneau Police Lieutenant Dave Campbell says the U.S. Coast Guard received a tip, which originated from a text.
Somebody on board the boat texted a friend that the boat captain appeared intoxicated, and that friend contacted the Coast Guard.
Coast Guard Chief Petty Officer Kip Wadlow says Sector Juneau launched a response boat.
They arrived at the Orca Odyssey's location. They boarded the vessel, conducted a field sobriety test with the vessel master. He did not pass the field sobriety test, and at that point, the Coast Guard terminated the vessel's voyage, escorted it back into port, disembarked the passengers, and then turned the captain over to the Juneau Police Department for processing.
Dupler was lodged at Lemon Creek Correctional Center on $1,500 bail. Orca Enterprises did not return calls for comment. The Southeast Alaska Land Trust plans to donate about 128 acres of land to the city and borough of Juneau this fall for preservation and natural recreation. This deal is technically an airport project. Most of the money the land trust used traces back to the Federal Aviation Administration. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has more.
The land is in the Mendenhall Valley, bounded by residential subdivisions to the north, city-owned land that hugs the Mendenhall River to the east, public land to the south, and Montana Creek to the west. Greg Cheney is Juneau's lands and resources manager.
It's mostly really rich wetlands, and they would just be left alone.
The trust's donation will be contingent on the preservation of the land as open space and for natural recreation. The plan is for new hiking trails and possibly an overnight campsite and community garden.
Basically, the west bank of the Mendenhall River will be an entire network of city trails. For a community of our size, it's an incredible trail network, and this is the capstone. I mean, this has been years in the making.
The reason this is connected to the FAA has to do with years of runway safety improvements at Juneau's airport, which wrapped up in December. Basically, the FAA required more flat land around the runway, which meant filling in the surrounding wetlands. Frank Rue is executive director of the Southeast Alaska Land Trust.
The Army Corps of Engineers required that they mitigate those wetlands impacts, and they chose to do it through the in-lieu fee program.
The FAA paid for more than 90% of the roughly $85 million runway safety work. Then, the airport paid the land trust $5 million to deal with its wetlands debt. Rue says about 86 acres of wetlands were lost. That translates into an obligation to preserve 227 acres of wetlands. Federal law discourages destroying wetlands because they're ecologically prized for their ability to naturally filter man-made pollution, provide flood relief, and support unique ecosystems. The land deal in the Mendenhall Valley will knock out about half of the mitigation debt. The details aren't set, but it's consistent with the city's long-term land use plans for the area, which includes improving a rough trail that follows Montana Creek. The Juneau Assembly must finalize the transfer. The Juneau Assessor's database lists the property's value at $20,000.
That's because, for the city's purposes, it's a conservation lot. They don't value it as a lot that is available for development.
Rue won't disclose how much the trust paid for the parcel, just that it was a much higher market rate before development was off limits. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Lisa Fu and Jeremy Shea in Juneau. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez and Liz Ruskin reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. ExxonMobil, employing over 1,000 Alaskans at their Point Thompson project. Employees who are knitting hats for kids in Koktovik in their spare time. Learn more at koktovikknits.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.